Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion with one of the signatories of a letter in today's Washington Post urging President Obama to say no to a war of choice with Iran. Paul Piller, the former National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, joins us to explain why he and many senior military officials are concerned that what is being billed as an Iran problem is an Israeli problem, and if there is a war with Iran, Israel will not be just a contributing factor, but the prime mover. Then we will speak with Bob Samuels, the president of University Council, who is in Sacramento at the state capitol, along with thousands of others, demonstrating against tuition hikes and education cuts that are decimating what was once the country's leader in public education, California, which now languishes near the bottom with Mississippi. Then finally, Anne-Marie O'Connor joins us in the studio. She's the author of a new book, The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Anne-Marie writes for The Washington Post from Mexico City, and we will hear about her recent investigations into how the Mexican drug cartels are kidnapping immigrant women from Central America and forcing them into the sex trade. We'll also discuss the ongoing struggle of returning art stolen by the Nazis to the rightful heirs of the original owners, most of whom were murdered by the Nazis. Joining us now is Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously served as Chief of Analytical Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence's Counterterrorist Center, and from 1997 to 1999 was Deputy Director of the Center. Paul Piller is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, signed a full-page letter to President Obama in today's Washington Post. Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Piller.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Ian.
And apparently today's meeting at the White House, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave President Obama a gift, which is a decorated copy of the Book of Esther, which recounts the story of the evil Persian king and his viceroy, Haman, who tried but failed to annihilate the Jewish people, and to which Netanyahu told the president, then too, they wanted to wipe us out. How much is this situation of a war with Iran being driven by that existential threat that the Israeli people feel, that was after all expressed on a number of occasions by President Ahmadinejad of Iran?
Well, it's being driven to a large degree by the, I should say, understandable fears of the Israeli people, which go well beyond the Netanyahu government, although Mr. Netanyahu has been the most forceful enunciator of that fear. I think we are dealing mainly in the realm of fear and emotion, and while it is, again, I emphasize, understandable in light of the absolutely awful anti-Israel rhetoric that we hear regularly from the Iranian leaders, and especially from President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, it's quite a different issue to ask what the actual effect of an Iranian nuclear weapon would be. I think it's particularly instructive when you look at the views of some very knowledgeable and dedicated Israelis beyond the Netanyahu government who have a different view of these sorts of things. At least a couple, no less than three, really, current or former heads of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, have spoken in very different terms from the prime minister. The current director of the service, Mr. Pardo, and a past director, Ephraim Halevi, have both explicitly said, no, an Iranian nuclear weapon would not be an existential threat to Israel. Yet another former and very well-known head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, once referred to the idea of an Israeli military strike on Iran as, quote, the stupidest idea I've ever heard, unquote. And I think what they are referring to implicitly is the fact that even if Iran got a nuclear weapon, Israel would retain overwhelming military superiority. partly through its own nuclear force, which most international think tanks who have looked at this issue estimate to be at least 100 warheads, maybe as much as 200 or possibly more, as well as delivery systems that would go well, well beyond anything Iran could muster.
So in a way, though, it feels like we've seen this movie before, Paul Pillar, in terms of the drumbeat. And I think it's fair to say that the drumbeat for the Iraq war, pretty much the same chorus are out there beating the drums. The neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq war, which, after all, the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewel described as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his legions into Germany in 9 AD. We know the damage that was done by that rush to war and the extent to which the justification for it was manufactured. And there's no question that the same neoconservatives are very much in the same circles. They're pushing the war, and they're very close to Netanyahu. And I haven't heard the remarks yet that Netanyahu is making tonight. We're waiting to hear what they are before AIPAC. But it seems like the remarks that you just made, quoting senior intelligence officials in Israel, echo Van Creewel's words, that the one thing that the one consistent thing about the neocons is that they're reckless and dangerous in terms of strategic blunders.
Well, there are indeed many disturbing parallels between the run-up to the Iraq war and what we're seeing now, especially the hyping, I think that's the right word, of the weapons of mass destruction and especially nuclear weapons dimension, and coupling that with all of the other loathsome characteristics that were true of the Saddam Hussein regime and we can say are true of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And yes, indeed, it is many of the same people and same elements making very much the same arguments. I would draw a couple of distinctions. Well, the obvious one, I think, to begin with is we do not have an incumbent U.S. administration which is hankering for a war. Instead, we have a president who I don't think wants war and is trying to juggle the pressure from the Israelis with domestic politics and what makes strategic sense. So that's quite different than what we had with the Bush administration. And I also would draw a difference, at least in degree, of how much the Israeli dimension is part of this. I think it would be fair to say that with the selling of the Iraq war, the Israel dimension was part of it, but only a contributing factor. I think we were talking mainly about a neoconservative ideology that had an existence and an energy of its own that did not solely depend on the idea of a threat to Israel. Whereas with this Iran issue today, all you have to do is look at where most of the rhetoric is coming from and the fact that we've reached a kind of peak of this issue to coincide with the AIPAC meeting and Mr. Netanyahu's visit this week, to realize that much more of the energy is coming specifically from the Israeli government.
Well, I suppose, though, the fact that Dick Cheney's daughter got the most applause at AIPAC yesterday for her withering attacks of the Obama administration and the extent to which her father was one of the main salesmen, if you will, for the Iraq war. I suppose there's some connection, right?
Oh, there certainly are. There are connections all over the place. Someone like William Kristol, who was one of the big movers for the Iraq war with his committee that he put together. Well, he's doing similar things now with regard to this issue. No, I just wanted to make some distinction between the two in terms of, as a matter of degree, how much the whole Israel dimension figures into the debate.
Well, I suppose the difference is that the Israel's friends here in the United States were the neoconservatives were pushed the Iraq war and were largely the architects of it. This time, the Iran war is being pushed by Israel itself, but at least by this government.
I think that's a good way to summarize it, yes.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Pillar, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was a National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He, along with a group of senior military officers, signed a full-page letter to President Obama in today's Washington Post. Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. And the letter is actually quite brief. I can read it. Dear Mr. President, the U.S. military is the most formidable military force on Earth, but not every challenge has a military solution. Unless we or an ally is attacked, war should be the option of last resort. Our brave servicemen and women expect you to exhaust all diplomatic and peaceful options before you send them into harm's way. Preventing a nuclear-armed Iran is rightfully your priority and your red line. Fortunately, diplomacy has not been exhausted and peaceful solutions are still possible. Military action at this stage is not only unnecessary, it is dangerous for the United States and for Israel. We urge you to resist the pressure of a war of choice with Iran. And then it's signed by Major General Paul Eaton, Tom Finger, former Deputy Director of National Intelligence and Analysis at the INR, State Department, Lieutenant General Robert Gard, General Joseph Hoare, former Commandant of the Marine Corps, Brigadier General John Johns, Major General Rudolf Ostrovich, and our guest today, Paul Pillar, along with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's Chief of Staff. So why the letter, Paul Pillar?
Because, as we've been discussing, the heat on this issue has become hotter than ever right now. You quite correctly said, Ian, that it's not a new issue. It's been around for a while. I've been writing about this for some time, and it reminds me how much the agitation for this has been going on for some time. I think what's different this year is not so much anything that the Iranians are doing with their centrifuges or their research, although, of course, we hear about that just about every week. It's more having to do with the U.S. electoral calendar and how that figures into Israeli governmental political calculations, and that's why the meetings today were so important. I don't have a direct insight, of course, into the thinking of Mr. Netanyahu's government, but given how important the playing, shall we say, of American politics works for Israeli leaders, no doubt the fact that an incumbent president, whom they don't probably especially like, given some of the frictions that there have been in the relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, is running for re-election, is facing the political realities in doing so that were represented at that convention hall, at that AIPAC meeting. But that if he is reelected, then come the second week in November, they would be facing an incumbent president who never is going to have to run for anything again. And I think my calculation, if I were sitting in Mr. Netanyahu's chair, is that if I was going to do anything forcefully, militarily on this Iranian matter, the next few months are the time to do it.
Well, that is the president's greatest fear, and apparently he's not been able to get any assurances. And there's no question that there is a history to the extent to which AIPAC and their influence over the U.S. Congress enforcing the issue. After all, the National Defense Authorization Act was pushed through by Lindsey Graham and Senator McCain and sold on the Hill by AIPAC. That the president threatened to veto that on the basis that it would cause the price of gasoline to rise, which it has, which has in turn become a main campaign theme for the Republicans. So without being too cynical, it would seem to me that given the fratricide going on between the Republican candidates, it's logical to assume that the only way or the best way to beat Obama would be a war where the president would be sidelined and embarrassed by a chorus of people, crying for us to join in the side of Israel. And meanwhile, of course, the price of gasoline would go through the ceiling.
Yes, that would be from the standpoint of Israeli hardliners on the right, and I include Mr. Netanyahu in that category, all a bonus for them. That is to say, anything from rising gasoline prices to whatever else causes controversy back here in the United States that would hurt Mr. Obama's reelection chances, that would be a good thing from their point of view. I don't think that the economic welfare of American consumers and workers would figure very high in their list of criteria that they would apply to their decision as to whether to launch a war or not.
So given that that the president hasn't been able to get these assurances out of Netanyahu, at least been able to tell us publicly that he has, and he's talked about other options being on the table, is it possible that then he's being forced into, it does seem strange that the superpower has to be the supplicant in this situation. Is he then saying to Netanyahu, look, lay off and once I get reelected, then maybe we'll take care of Iran then. And by the way, we the U.S. have the means to do so. And the Israelis could cause nothing but trouble, but they wouldn't be able to knock the program out.
Well, it's been strange for a long time that the superpower is a supplicant, and that deals with many issues beyond this one. What the president's clearly trying to do in holding off this prospect of an Israeli attack in the next few months is to use all his persuasion he can in saying, yes, diplomacy is still promising, and yes, I'm doing everything I can with regard to sanctions to support that effort, and to try to buy enough time by doing those things, and also as a sort of counterweight to that, to talk tough, just as we heard him before AIPAC yesterday, on two particular themes. One, that he's still got the so-called military option on the table. And secondly, repeatedly and unequivocally saying that an Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable. Now, what he seems to be doing, or at least this is my guess, what the president is doing, is he is gambling that the diplomacy will be able to pay off soon enough that sometime, while he is still president, he can turn to Netanyahu and say, yes, it indeed worked. That is a gamble because there are many things, even though I wholeheartedly agree with everything the president said, and as we said in the letter, that there's a lot of diplomacy yet to be tried. There's also a lot of ways in which the diplomacy can be subverted, and I think the Israeli government is doing some of that already with regard to the terrorist attacks against Iranian scientists, with regard to levying demands about no uranium enrichment at all, which is really a non-starter for the Iranians. Any deal that we manage to reach with Tehran is going to have to allow for some kind of continued enrichment program under safeguard. And Netanyahu, in his remarks up in Canada before he got here to Washington, seemed to be just flatly ruling out negotiations. He said it's just too dangerous. You know, don't do that with the Iranians. So with that kind of, criticism and complication from the Israeli side, that's going to make the negotiations harder than ever, even though we do indeed have to pursue them. I don't know if the president has some other rabbit in his hat that he hopes to pull out, but that's what seems to me to be the strategy. And his main concern is getting through these next several months without a war being started.
Well, but surely the record of the same people who are promoting this war and what happened with Iraq, where essentially Iran won the Iraq war, and if you were to attack Iran, wouldn't they win that war? First of all, the situation in Syria would completely reverse in the sense that a noxious dictatorship would be the greatest reprieve they could hope for. The Israelis wouldn't be able to stop the Iranian program significantly. The world would rally against it. The entire Western economies would be in trouble because of the price of oil. That would benefit Chavez and Putin, but nobody else. The downside's pretty enormous, isn't it?
The downside is enormous. None of us know exactly what the consequences would be. I have little doubt that the Iranians would find their own asymmetric ways, mainly through clandestine attacks, to respond. I think the economic effects, some of which you just mentioned, would be the most salient immediate effects. Beyond that, I'd mention some other things that you didn't touch on. The political consequences inside Iran would be very likely in the direction of bolstering support for the Iranian hardliners in a traditional rally-round-the-flag sort of effect. And beyond that, you have the longer-term effects both in poisoning relations with generations of Iranians, as well as lending extremist ideologists and groups one more big, huge propaganda point in stoking anti-Americanism throughout the Muslim world. This would be one more instance of either the United States or what is seen as its Israeli client killing Muslims for their own purposes. This would not do us any good. And so this whole range of things, short-term economic consequences, long-term political consequences, would indeed be overwhelmingly negative. And it, at most, would set back the Iranian nuclear efforts only by a couple of years.
Well, in order to get rid of a president that the Israeli prime minister may not like, and his Republican friends over here clearly almost hate obsessively, it sounds to me like a huge price to pay. And hopefully it is such a horrible prospect that it simply won't happen. But the very fact that we're even having this discussion, and we're not making this up because we know this is what the president and the prime minister have been talking about at the White House today. And it's a pretty appalling set of affairs, even if the worst doesn't happen, isn't it?
Well, it is extraordinary. But at least if there's a glimmer of something more positive here, there is some realistic thinking in Israel. I mentioned some of it earlier in our conversation with regard to some of the people who, by their own experience, are deeply committed to the security of the state of Israel and have the expertise to discuss it. And in many Israeli minds, individual minds, I think there's a tussle between those very sound strategic considerations that people like Ephraim Halevi and Meir Dagan have mentioned as to why it would be a mistake to go to war with Iran. There's a tussle between that and the more emotional aspect, the fear that you would have something in the terms in which Netanyahu describes it, a repeat of the Holocaust. I think the great majority of knowledgeable Israelis know that that is not really what we're dealing with here, but it is hard to get out of their minds and their hearts the emotion and the fear that goes with that. And I guess it's hard for many of us to put ourselves in the same position, but that's basically the mental and emotional struggle that's going on inside Israel today.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Paul Piller.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Piller, who served for 30 years as an analyst at the CIA, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Previously served as Chief of Analytical Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He also headed the Assessments and Information Group of the Director of Central Intelligence Counterterrorist Center, and from 97 to 99 was Deputy Chief of the Center. Paul Piller is currently a professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a member of the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He, along with a group of senior military officers, signed a full-page letter to President Obama in today's Washington Post. Mr. President, say no to a war of choice with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go up to Sacramento, where there's a vast student demonstration taking place, and we'll talk to one of the organizers.
Man is supposed to be playing. Wants it all and it wants it this way. Now there's a woman on my block. She just sits there as the night grows still. Saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Whose life's so secure?
Yo.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bob Samuels, who's president of the University Council and a lecturer at UCLA. He's also the author of the popular blog Changing Universities and the book New Media, Cultural Studies and Critical Theory After Postmodernity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Samuels.
Thanks.
And you're up at Sacramento along with thousands of college students protesting the rising tuition costs and the escalating cuts in California's education budget. What's happened so far, and who's listening to you?
Well, there's a lot of people that are still actually inside the Capitol. They're trying to occupy the Capitol, and some are want to stay there over the night, kind of do something like Wisconsin. Meanwhile, there's a rally outside going on, and we've been lobbying, meeting with different legislators and people from the Brown administration. And so basically, you know, talking about the importance of raising revenue to support higher education in the state of California. Like 20 years ago, we were one of the most educated states in the country, and now we're at the bottom. And it really has to do with revenue, the lack of taxes, and also that we spend so much money now on prisons and health care.
So in terms of the legislatures, and you're there occupying the rotunda, what are you hearing from the representatives, and what are you hearing from the governor?
Well, you know, what we've heard is that the governor does have a tax initiative that he wants to be voted on. It's different from the one we support. We support the millionaire tax. It would dedicate money to higher education. It would be more money than the governor's. And the governor's is going to basically tax everyone, and even people that are, you know, making very little money. And so ours, you know, taxing mostly the millionaires, we think that's the way to go. And the problem is the legislature is supporting at this point the governor. And so we might have two or three different tax initiatives out there. So the legislators are saying that they support higher education. Yes, we need more money for higher education. And they're saying that they will support a tax initiative right now with the governors. We hope that they switch to the millionaire's tax.
But every politician almost in this country and at the national level, we're hearing it, they always run on the platform, we need better education, we need a more skilled workforce, we've got to compete with the Chinese in our new global economy. Yet the first thing that they cut, particularly at the state level, is education. And I don't understand it, and I don't understand why they can't be called on this fundamental hypocrisy.
Well, usually, like California, the problem is that higher education is something that's not built into the budget, right? We have Prop 98 that funds K through 12, and there's nothing to guarantee funding to higher education. So when there's a budget cut and there's no taxes coming in, they have to cut something, so they always end up cutting higher education, and they figure, well, just let the students take out debt, let them take out loans, and, you know, now it's a $1 trillion student loan market out there. And basically, no one wants to raise taxes. And what we have here in California, we hope, is the start of a reversal of the movement that started with Prop 13. We think we're going to be able to tax the millionaires. We're going to be able to start funding public education and other vital services, and we're going to cause a reversal of what happened with Prop 13. So we're trying to really reverse a 40-year war against middle-class and lower-class workers and families.
And I understand that up to 10,000 students have made their way to the Capitol. And in a morning press conference, some of the speakers from the California State Universities and the University of California campuses pointed out that the cost of attending a California State University or University of California campus has surpassed that of the top private schools such as Harvard for middle-income students.
Well, there's two things to that. One thing, yes, for middle-income students, because they get very high financial aid at Harvard. But the problem is there's no middle-class students at Harvard. I mean, it's still something like 85 to 90% of the students at the most elite universities come from the top, you know, 25% of earners in the country. And so they're still incredibly elite. But the point is basically that it's starting to become a problem, that it's becoming so expensive public education that it is cheaper to go to some private university.
So what is the, in terms of the, it, I guess what's going on here is that the legislature and the governor are basically taxing the parents who can afford to get their kids into California schools, both the state schools and the University of California, and this is just a backdoor way of raising revenues.
That's what it is. It's basically every time they cut taxes or they don't raise taxes and they cut higher education, it's taken out. You know, middle class students have to pay more money, and it's basically they have to take out loans, and so they end up paying more. And so the middle class people should wake up in California and realize they're paying more for everything because the wealthy don't want to pay taxes.
And that, and thus your millionaire's tax, right?
Exactly.
So how's that message resonating? I mean, we know we have a completely dysfunctional state government where basically it's minority rule. A handful of Republican ideologues are able to essentially paralyze the entire capital because of Proposition 13, the requirements for two-thirds majorities on the important issues of budgets and revenues and taxes. And that's only three states have that unique combination. And actually, California is, I think, alone in having that, being shackled in that way. That's the heart of the problem, isn't it, Bob Samuels?
That's about half of it. I mean, the other problem is we did pass Prop 25, you know, and that allowed for just a simple majority of votes for the budget. And so now we don't need Republicans to pass the budget. And one of the problems is, yes, it's hard to raise revenue, but the other problem is Democrats keep on supporting budgets that cut vital services like higher education. And so we need to put pressure on both sides. But if we go to the ballot box with the initiative and the millionaire's tax now, I think it's polling at like 70%, it's very popular and it has a very good chance of passing. And so I think we're going to force the legislature and the governor to do the right thing.
And this can be done without having to resort to the only means to get anything done in the state of California, which is the referendum process.
Right. We're doing a ballot initiative, and it's going to be in the November election, and right, it'll be a presidential election. We hope to bring out a lot of people. And right now, in the current situation, it's hard to get any Republicans to vote to get the supermajority, but the Democrats in the state feel because of redistricting, they're going to be able to get a two-thirds majority of Democrats. And so the goal of the legislators is to make sure that the Democrats get the two-thirds vote in the legislature, you know, in November. And so they're concentrating on that. And they're also working with the governor on his plan.
So, again, the only way you get anything done in the state of California is through the initiative process, whether it's for good or ill.
We only have to win like three or four seats for the Democrats to be able to have a supermajority and be able to pass taxes on their own. I don't know if they would necessarily do the right thing, but we're pretty close. And the redistricting gives a lot of Democrats the opportunity to take those seats. So it might change right there. We might have a very different politics then.
Right. But nevertheless, the millionaire's tax initiative will be on the ballot by the look of it, right?
Well, yeah, once we collect the signatures, and we're pretty sure we're going to be able to do that. And we're signing up lots of people here. Everyone's talking about it here. There's signs everywhere. There's petitions everywhere. And so this has been a really great event for that.
Well, Bob Samuels, I thank you for joining us here today and for filling us in on how people power has showed up in Sacramento and, you know, in that dysfunctional place where you just explained the only way to get things done is by two things, going to the initiative process, which has been...
This is like the only hope. I mean, the left coast here, this is the only hope. So we're trying to reverse it. We're trying to tax the millionaires, and hopefully that all happens.
Well, I thank you again, Bob.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bob Samuels, president of the University Council and lecturer at UCLA. He's also the author of the popular blog Changing Universities and the book New Media, Cultural Studies and Critical Theory After Postmodernity. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to the author of a new book, The Lady in Gold. She's also the works for the Washington Post in Mexico City, where she's been investigating how the drug cartels are kidnapping immigrant women from Central America and use turning them into the sex slave trade.
I learned a good way. Working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty. Dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms. And if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a cop up and not get charged. And it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Anne-Marie O'Connor, the author of a new book just out, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Previously, she was a foreign correspondent for Reuters and a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times for 12 years and has written extensively on the Klimt painting and the Bloch-Bauer family's efforts to recover its art collection. She currently writes for the Washington Post from Mexico City, where her husband, William Booth, is the Washington Post bureau chief. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Marie O'Connor.
Thank you for having me.
And just before we get into your book, The Lady in Gold, I just covered a bit of the recently Mexico's war on drugs, the never-ending war on drugs, which clearly I think will be a big centerpiece in the upcoming presidential elections. But you've been doing some coverage down there of some of the more appalling aspects of the price that Mexico's paying for the war on drugs, where you've been covering how the drug cartels kidnap women for sex trafficking. Can you give us a bit of a sketch of the work that you've been doing?
Yes. According to U.S. officials, the drug cartels are now expanding into other businesses. One of those businesses, in the case of the Zetas drug cartel, one of the most ruthless cartels in Mexico, they are expanding into sex traffic. Women who come over the border from Central America who want to go and work in the United States, often to support their children that they leave back in Central America, are coming up through Mexico on trains. Zetas drug cartel members, collaborating with the police often and other authorities, often watch the immigrants come off the trains, and they choose the women that they want and take them to their safe houses. Now, this also happens on the highways at checkpoints. They stop women and invite them into safe houses. Often the women are unaware of who they are. They're offered sometimes food and water. Once in these safe houses, some of the women are selected for members of the drug cartel. Other women have been taken to the northern border, where they're taken from bars to brothels. In one case, a Zetas group kidnapped some women and tattooed them with a Z on their arm as a Zetas acquisition,
right,
and took them to brothels against their will. And this is something, according to diplomats, that drug cartels are moving into, particularly the Zetas.
Well, you know, it's an interesting and morbid kind of connection here to your book, Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. As much as you tell the story of the heirs of the family that had the painting and what happened to them during the Holocaust, you know, people forget, I guess, how hideous it all was. I was reading your book towards the end there. The fate of so much artwork was in the hands of these SS guys who were at this big chateau. And for sport, they were pulling people out of the labor camps. And for amusement at parties, they'd shoot them and have them run, you know, across the lawn like rabbits, and even have their girlfriends participate in the shooting of prisoners. And the whole story of what happened to these people and how they had to sort of sell their souls to the Nazis and how criminal the whole operation was. And of course, you know, as we all know, the prisoners who were marched into the death camps and onto their deaths were all tattooed as well. I know it's a bit of a reach, but I guess we're talking about the continuum of human cruelty here.
Well, of course, the world was horrified by the atrocities of the Holocaust, but the unaddressed wrongs have lingered on into the modern times with insurance accounts, bank accounts, leases, unpaid pensions. And now finally the world is getting around to resolving the art claims. Now, Hitler's army stole 20% of the art in Europe. Tens of thousands of these works have not been returned, and they were hidden away in apartments, castles, sold on the gray market to people who were willing to buy stolen art to hang in their homes. In the case of these paintings in this book, they were not locked away in some mysterious place. These paintings were hanging in the National Art Museum in Austria. Now, this is not completely unusual. Austria, since this case began of the Blockbauer Klimts, Austria has returned a dozen Klimt paintings that were hanging in national museums, 10 of them in the Belvedere, the Austrian gallery, the main art gallery, the Louvre of Middle Europe. So the unique aspect of these paintings is that they were very prominent in public. And this is not that uncommon, this was not that uncommon when this case began. There were paintings in the galleries and in the art museums. When heirs approached the art museums and asked them, I think this belonged to my uncle, I think this may have been stolen, the museums always responded, no, these were donations. And this is what they told many heirs, including the heirs to an enormous Rothschild collection that was also returned.
So this story, though, has a Los Angeles connection. The painting itself, of course, scandalized Viennese society in, 1907? The Klimt and the subject perhaps had an affair. That's an assumption, right, but not a wild one.
This painting was created in a very specific time and place, in turn of the century of Vienna, what people now call the Age of Freud. A very exciting, cutting-edge time where people were embracing new ideas of art, music, and psychology. The women that Klimt painted were his patrons. They sustained his development as an artist and his progression into innovative modern art. Now, this painting is considered the apex of his painted mosaic style. He was at the height of his gold paintings, his gold series, and the painting of this woman is encoded with Egyptian eyes of Horus, symbols of protection and power, but also with almond-shaped designs that many people saw as coding for female sex. So it was a very incendiary painting on many levels.
And without getting into Klimt's somewhat wild sex life, right? We don't have to go there. But the long and the short of it is that the Germans seized this painting during World War II, and that the heirs here based in Los Angeles, aided by the grandson of the composer Arnold Schoenberg, tried to wrest them away. And after a long legal battle, the painting was returned to the heirs and then ultimately sold for a record amount of money to Estee Lauder heir Ron Lauder. That's the historical sketch, right?
Yes, that is correct. This painting became a landmark restitution case. As time wore on, it wasn't just about the restitution of a painting, but about the restitution of history. Because as this 8-year legal battle was waged by Randall Schoenberg, a Los Angeles attorney, many other heirs came forward and started to ask for their paintings. In an art show in the year 2000 called Klimt's Women at the Belvedere Museum in Vienna, they opened the show, and the heirs to the poster of the show immediately stepped forward to claim the painting, Lady with Feather Hat and Boa. And there were turned out to be many stolen paintings in this show. And the inclusion of the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, this gold portrait, prompted one Vienna journalist to compare the museum to a bloody gangster's mall parading around with jewelry they claim the victim gave them as a present. This painting was the catalyst for many of these other cases, of these other dozen paintings that were returned.
So we have all kinds of historical overlaps here. We started out talking about the brutality in Mexico and how it reminded me, at least, of some of the brutality that you unveil in this new book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, Anne Marie O'Connor, and the history of how this painting was recovered. And now, of course, it's in the hands, I think it was sold for a record amount of money, in the hands of Ron Lauder, the heir to Estee Lauder, who, by the way, is the poster boy for the 1%. He is the guy that literally has invented all of the tax laws to preserve inheritance. A very much, as I say, a poster boy for those people who inherited money and don't want to pay taxes. So what am I saying here? You're not...
Well, Ron Lauder is the owner. Ron Lauder is the director of the Neue Gallery. This is a museum that showcases Germanic art and art of this period, of German Expressionist art, and the work of artists such as Gustav Klimt. Now, this museum, to some degree, is an appropriate home for that painting because in Austria, the story of this painting was not known. The story of Klimt's female models as patrons of his art was relatively unknown until this case arose. And now it's in a place where they can actually tell this history and showcase the painting with its authentic heritage.
And presumably this family that was so wronged have ended up fairly wealthy.
I mean, yes, that is correct. I think that is a safe assumption.
What was it, 104?
The painting was sold for $135 million, and then other paintings were sold at auction for others, uh-huh. including the second portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. I think the total proceeds were somewhere around $325 million.
Good Lord.
So.
And how much was destroyed by that SS guy that showed up on a bicycle just at the end of the war and set the place on fire?
Well, one of the terrible aspects of the terrible World War II, at the end of the war, Hitler decreed the demolition on Reich territory, which was known as the Nero Decree, where they were supposed to burn everything in advance of the enemy. Just as in Hitler's fantasies in those days, he was thinking just as Vienna burned the buildings outside of its walls in the advance of the Turks. So to serve the Nero Decree, across Austria and in Germany, people marched out slave laborers and shot them. They burned castles. They destroyed things. It never got very far because the Nazi leader who was in charge with carrying it out lost his nerve. But before it fizzled, SS officers held an enormous party at a castle in Austria where 15 or more Klimt paintings were stored. It was one of the greatest collections of the work of Gustav Klimt and some of his most important works. At the end of this party, apparently they set off dynamite charges throughout the building, and those set off ammunition that had been stored there by German army soldiers. So the entire castle blew up and burned to the ground. Now, no one will ever know how many paintings were in there because some of them are still outstanding and unaccounted for, but probably 15 paintings burned there. And it was really a tragedy. These great works of art were destroyed, and some of them had not been photographed in color. They'd only been photographed in black and white at that time because they'd been stolen from Jewish collections, one in particular, and taken from their homes and put in National Museum and then taken to this castle for storage during the war. And they had not had a chance to photograph them in color. So there, for some of these paintings, there are no color reproductions. So that was one of the tragedies at the end of the war.
So again, I'm speaking with Anne-Marie O'Connor, the author of the new book just out, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. And just to return, if I can, to the work that you've been doing in Mexico City, where you have been writing for the Washington Post. Your husband's the bureau chief down there. And you've told us at the beginning you've been writing about how the drug cartels have been kidnapping women for sex trafficking. And clearly, the war on drugs are weighing heavily on the Mexican elections, aren't they?
That is correct. The war on drugs as an issue, on how to deal with it, on whether money is getting into elections campaigns, drug money, it's become a huge issue there. Whether the violence is really worth the drug war. In other words, whether going after the drug traffickers is worth the violence that has ensued in Mexico. It's certainly the central issue that people talk about in Mexico now.
And isn't there sort of an anti-American angle to it, or subtext, in as much as a lot of Mexicans feel they're fighting the drug war on behalf of the Americans, and they're the ones that are getting killed. And the Americans are the customers for these drugs. And also they supply the arms with which the cartels are killing the police and other Mexicans.
Well, yeah, to Mexicans at all social levels, it's very ironic that drug use is so endemic in the United States, yet they're going after the producers of drugs in Mexico so energetically and spending so many resources, Mexican resources and lives, as well as U.S. resources. One of the criticisms that many Mexicans have is that it's hypocritical when marijuana is grown in California and used for medical purposes here and it, to some degree endorsed for that use, that they take such pains to destroy marijuana plantations in Mexico, and because it just seems like a contradiction to many Mexicans.
So does it mean then that the outgoing president who prosecuted this war, that his party is toast? And conversely, does it mean that the Free Party, even though some of their candidates are having problems, who in many ways had an alliance with the drug cartels when they were in power, is this exhaustion factor going to make it easier for perhaps a pre-comeback?
It will certainly play a role in the elections. It's too soon to tell whether it will be decisive in the case of the PAN party, the ruling party, because the strengths and the weaknesses of the candidates will also play into this. But certainly I think it gave an early help to the pre-candidate at the beginning of the races.
And what about the PRD, the López Obrador's party? He allegedly won the last election, or certainly his predecessor won back at the time that Salinas won and the ballots were burned. Is there any sense that they're going to make a comeback, or is he just sort of whistling, baying in the wind?
Well, he's been much more modest in the polls, of course, than the last round of elections. But, of course, his supporters are still very hopeful, and he has some strong supporters.
So tell me about what you're going to be doing tomorrow night at the Skirball Cultural Center here in Los Angeles, Amory O'Connor. You'll be at the Zocalo.
I'll be at the Zocalo. I'll be talking about this painting, which, even though it has its roots in turn-of-the-century Vienna, for me, it was an L.A. story, and I came across this in Los Angeles. Just in an item that I read in a community newspaper, the West Side Weekly, I read that a neighborhood woman in 2001 was trying to get back a painting of her aunt from Austria. And this was very common in those days. You read about this all the time, and people never got these paintings back. They were in Europe. It was very difficult and presented a lot of legal challenges. But I looked at a picture of the painting, and I thought, oh, my God, that painting, because it's one of the most recognizable paintings in the world. So I called 411, and I got the number of this woman in the newspaper, and I called her on the phone, and she invited me over. And she told me the most amazing story about her aunt, who is a patron of Gustav Klimt, and part of a group of very remarkable women who were also his patrons, who were suffragettes and socialists and atheists and tremendously intellectual women of their times. And she talked about how these paintings of these women represented this very unique time in Klimt's artistic history.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and it's an extraordinary story. And I wish we had more time, because I want to talk to you about the work that you're doing now in Mexico City, because, we have this strange relationship with a first world country and in many ways a third world country sharing such a long common border and having so much of their relationship is defined by this dysfunctional war on drugs. I know we keep revisiting it and we keep repeating the same story largely. Is that
well, I think this is an issue that's not going to go away. There's no clear answer in sight. The problem remains. The violence remains. It's a problem that's shared by both countries. And the problem of consumption remains in the United States. So I just don't think this is an issue. I think this is something you'll be talking about in 6 months, too.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Anne-Marie O'Connor.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Anne-Marie O'Connor, the author of Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Previously, she was a foreign correspondent for Reuters and a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times for 12 years and has written extensively on the Klimt paintings and the Bloch-Bauer family's efforts to recover its art collection. She currently writes for the Washington Post from Mexico City, where her husband, William Booth, is the Washington Post bureau chief. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Paul Pillar, a very senior guy inside the CIA. He lived through the Iraq War, knows what a catastrophe it was for the United States, and sees the same drumbeat of war happening, the same neocons who ginned up the Iraq War are now ginning up a war with Iran. The difference this time, however, is that the first war was not on behalf of Israel, although the neocons are close to Netanyahu. This war is entirely Israel's idea, and Netanyahu, through AIPAC and their support on Capitol Hill, support on both sides, are pushing hard for this war, and the president still could be stuck with a war that he doesn't want. It's amazing that you even have to have a conversation like this, and it makes you wonder about the superpower, who's in charge here. Then we spoke about this big demonstration. 10,000 students today converged on the California State Capitol in Sacramento. I talked with Bob Samuels, the president of the University Council, and he's one of the organizers of this Occupy the Capitol movement that's taking place. It's a pretty disgraceful to think that the state of California was the country's leader in public education, and it's now languishing near the bottom with Mississippi, simply because what money used to be spent on education now goes to prisons. And Samuels and the Occupy California Capitol demonstrators want a millionaire's tax, which they feel that they'll get on the ballot. There's no way in the state of California, because of the dysfunctional nature of the legislature with the requirements of 2/3 majorities for taxes and revenues and budgets, that the legislature will ever pass any kind of meaningful ways to rescue education from the chopping block. And it does seem that that's the first thing that people want to cut. Then we spoke with Anne-Marie O'Connor, who works down in Mexico City with the Washington Post. She's been covering the drug war from the angle of the women being kidnapped and sent into the slave trade, the Central American immigrants. It's a chilling story. She also has an amazing book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting. You can also, where you can also contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The man she loved.